Oral History Program tape for Ranch Hand, tape 80-2, 10 October 1980, Tarpon Springs, Florida. General discussion.
Who was the name? We come back from the mission. It seemed like a fighter pilot that bellied in or something, but they gave us a go around. I know I'd find co-pilot, and it seemed like it was years on. Whoever in the hell it was went down the entire length of the runway, I think, scraping the belly, and pulled up into one of these damn near loop overhead chandelles. And for the next couple of weeks, every time we come back, go around. Those
they want to see it now.
They want to see that damn thing go again.
Sure.
But the first time, you know, it was an actual go around. But from then on, they said, go around.
Well, I used to do an air show on a T-6, you know, and none of that stuff seems, you know, as long as you knew the airplane, it was safe as hell. I didn't think there was anything daring about what we were doing. That wasn't spectacular to make a 360 overhead and a 123. It's not a big deal.
Well,
the fighter pilots thought it wasn't.
You went through the training before I did.
Yeah.
Well, for the ranch hand bit, I mean, I went through 123 training in about 59 or 60. And the tack, they had that 360 overhead where you'd come over, the hell was it, 300 feet, cut the power, drop the flaps, and the full flaps.
Never put power back on.
And you were doing your damnedest rollout before you hit the ground.
300 feet?
300. Well,
that's
123?
Mm-hmm. Why? Probably 500.
That, no, it was there.
You mean 300 feet over the touchdown point?
Yeah, and you couldn't turn that so much around.
With no power fix, you couldn't get around 90 degrees.
Well, I had one of them demonstrated to me by the tack crew checking me out. And I mean, they were working to pull that so much out before we hit. When they reversed 50 feet in the air, too.
Now that's about the dumbest thing I could think of ever doing.
There was a lot of that going around.
Reverse 50 feet in the air.
Doc Weaver did that to me once.
They must have been in a straight down dive to reverse like that. That sounds like bullshit.
I had a lot of airspeed.
Trash haulers didn't play that. They had a max steep approach of 77 knots.
Well, how many of you've all done this? Probably come in over the runway when it went out of sight, drop the full flaps, and break the wire.
That's standard.
Put your foot on the stick and push it and hope to hell you got the airspeed.
Hell, I can do that in a 707 at 5,000 feet. I can make you tell me that there's no way in hell you hit that runway and just come in just as nice as anything.
With a 123, you couldn't even get the airspeed you're supposed to have by pushing the stick all the way from forward.
One of the things may be gapping, and you were asking about the cage. Those jets were nothing but nice, but one of the basic problems with it, if you get into trash hauling, you know, you get down there, okay, well, we'll start the boobs today, we need to haul some wounded out or something else. So you get back in the dirt, and in the first couple landings, you know, you've been coming in, zooming, you know, on 11,000 foot runways, and all once you're looking at 1,800 feet. Of course, you come in there shooting like hell and everything else. Well, the built-in problem with the airplane, talking about two good pilots, when you reverse, which you have to, that kills the jets. And which really required a lot of cockpit discipline, because this what the guy sitting in the right seat, he's just got to run that checklist and get those goddamn engines started. Because a lot of times, at least if I'm running a show, I tell that guy in the back, I'm never stopping. Don't you get off that goddamn airphone, because I'm going to throw out pallets of machine gun stuff or what have you. But starting those engines and what have you, you know, you really were busy.
Those were the wafer switch with the electric, you had the position.
Yeah, well, the dash one said, you know, you got to put it, well, I don't remember the numbers, but like you put it over to position one till it got to 8%.
That was start, yeah.
But in reality, all you had to do is just put the wafer switch all the way over.
Yes.
All the way to run and let it go through the sequence itself.
If you did it the way the tech order said, it'd still run, but you didn't need to do all that shit. All you do is just move it, you know. But you still had to restart it.
I got one fly in up in Ohio. What the hell? Where do they move the transition to?
What they Clinton, should, or not Clinton County? Is that the one over at, or?
No, they're over. They're at Lockburn.
Lockburn.
Well, I thought for a while they originally planned to go to Clinton County.
No, they have a reserve.
Okay.
No, this was when I was going back to Vietnam in '69.
Okay. This is where Air Commandos moved up to Lockburn. Yeah.
Well, what's his name coming in today? Can tell you all about that.
I didn't like that man.
The guy from what's the pockmarked guy's face? Lives up in Herbert. Yeah, Chalk's roommate. What was his name?
Who, Spey?
No.
Ed Murrow.
Murrow. Yeah, he was in that Columbus outfit.
He got transferred out.
Well, I've got one flight in that damn thing, and I didn't like it. I preferred it without the jets.
When was Charlie there?
Charlie was there in 66-67 until June 67.
Have to be careful with Charlie, huh?
Charlie, who?
Well, I got my orders to back to Vietnam, and I hit Lock Bend in September 69.
Listen to him long enough, you'd think he was there 10 years.
And like I said, I got one, well, I got a couple of flights, but I wasn't supposed to. Really. When I got there, they had the orders waiting on me to retire me.
No, in 60, well, when Jim got there in 67, and I got there January of 68. Now, by that time,
no, January 68.
You got there just in time for Tet Offensive.
Yeah, we lost.
That was good timing on your part, I don't think.
Lost the Hooch. My Hooch was one of the ones that went to.
Yeah, Field Grade Hooch got wiped out, didn't it?
Well, we only had four left. That's the way it was.
Three of them got wiped out.
Four. In fact, I ran into my Hooch that night. Man, I'm telling you, things were just going off all over, and goddamn electrical lights were falling, you know. And being my size, which I don't know how big you were, but I was the same size then, you know. You just don't go walk in a BX and get re-outfitted. So I went, they come on the speaker, you know, go down to...
That was the next day, or the day after.
Well, that night, though, they evacuated us out of our Hooches up in our, or not of our Hooches, but out of our bunkers. They said, get your ass down to, you know, on the way to the hangars or someplace. And I went running back through my Hooch, but that one with air conditioning was burning already. I just took everything out of my locker and threw it on my sheet, and I threw my sheet over my shoulder and went running out the other door on the way I was supposed to go. And I ran about two blocks. Now, that's enough of that shit. And I was by an air policeman there standing with a little shack, you remember? We used to walk by that shack all the way on the way back from the flight line. And I yelled my name at this guy. I said, you guard this son of a bitch till I come back. When I come back there about 7 o'clock in the morning, there's my sheet dirty as hell with all my clothes in. We had guys the next day, though. They were in the bunker, maybe with their shorts on or togs. And that's all they had.
Nothing left.
Huh? And I don't know who was the commander there, but they called up the BX and everything, and everybody went over. You didn't have to pay or anything, just sign, you know, and you could pay later.
They open up the BX and let you pick out whatever you wanted in shirts. And
what was it, 67?
No,
but that's the January, February 68.
But all that crap about standing down, that next day is the only day we didn't fly. Only day.
One day off.
Did the flight line get hit on that?
Did
it lose any birds?
No,
lose any, but they did on the base. They lost several birds.
They got a couple of hundreds hit.
Yeah.
I think we had a couple little teeny-weeny holes, but we're kind of in the category where they had to inspect everything. And we'd been up all night.
Now, was the ranch revetted at that time?
No.
You had no revetments?
The ranch was never revetted.
No.
The only place where there was any semblance of a revetment was up at the Nang. Wall behind them there. That wasn't a full revetment either.
Now, we spent the whole next day, you know, finding places for people to sleep and getting clothes and flight plan for the next day. That was the only day that they didn't fly.
Of course, we went into airlift, emergency airlift right up there.
Well, another thing that was said here earlier, which is not true, that we didn't spray for 6 weeks and was in airlift. That's bullshit.
That's right.
We didn't go.
We went in the airlift
for 6 weeks?
That's what he told me yesterday.
I didn't say 6 weeks.
Oh,
3 weeks.
Was it three?
Three weeks.
I know it was a lengthy period of time. I don't know.
I don't remember.
He just said it was only one day.
That's what the records say.
No. We went in an emergency airlift for 3 weeks anyway, and then later that year in 68, October.
And we partially sprayed.
Well, we went in a partial airlift. Yeah. It was some kind of an exercise or something. They took half of the birds in airlift, but we kept the spray program going.
What did you pull the tanks out?
Limited basis. No. Oh, yeah, for emergency airlift, we took the tanks
out. Were the tanks out? They were.
Shit, yes.
Well, you know,
we took the tanks out and the booms out.
Yeah, right.
This is in your random mission report, I know, but the guys that were flying this were not trained for airlift, right?
Well, they were as much trained for airlift as the airlift guys were.
You went through the first
portion of the Hurlburt training was all airlift. Then the ranch training was only an added, what was it, 3 weeks or a month or something?
Seemed like,
got mine at Langley.
Seemed like I learned how to be a rancher longer than it took me to learn how to be a pilot.
I think it was an extra month, 4 weeks training. And then you were so-called ranch qualified.
Well, that first airlift landing is a little exciting because you've been, you know, like I said before, you've been looking at 11,000-foot runways coming in 130. Now, all
of concrete.
All what you're looking at, dirt and stick shakers and trees and all that kind of stuff. So you're a little apprehensive.
Try that with a single-engine guy that's never flown a ball in his life.
That was one of the reasons why we had a little leverage over there in Vietnam. You see, we were... Well, as you all know, we belong to the wing, you know, the 315th wing.
Fighter wing.
No, it was
315th. It was Air Commando wing, 315th wing.
Not the fan rang.
Had the trash haulers and the 12.
They had five squadrons, four trash haulers and the ranch. And there wasn't any commonality. The only commonality in the whole damn thing was the airplane. We had C-123 airplanes, and that was all.
I thought we were actually the fighter wing.
Fighter wing was responsible for our maintenance.
Okay.
And for personnel insofar as general
well,
personnel.
Well, you as a commander could give shit less about the other. You dealt with our people, right, on our base. The fighter commander, was he your chain of command?
No. It was Van Rang.
Van Rang with 315.
That was one of the goddamn problems you were in all the time.
Well, I didn't know.
The 12th was a transient, a tenant.
My job was to go to the crapper and check what I flew. You know, that job.
You had a DM and a DO and all these staff people in the wing at Van Rang dictating to you from time to time as to what the hell you were going to do and how you were going to do it. And that used
and that, to get, they knew nothing of your operation?
That used to get real jazzy. I mean, I remember one particular, I was telling somebody about it last night. I don't know, the oxygen tank bit. Who did I talk to last night about? Was it you?
Mm-hmm.
We had oxygen tanks in the airplane with lines and holes. Now, the whole bit probably weighed empty. They were all empty. They weren't.
Yeah.
300 pounds. Dave Willoughby, who was my maintenance chief there, came to me one day and he said, we got all this oxygen stuff in here. He said, you know, we need all the weight out of there we can get. And he says, how about taking it out? I said, go ahead.
Going down to the stall?
I said, go ahead, take it out. Stick it back someplace. We may have to put it back in sometime later, but...
Put it with the heaters, right?
Hide it over there someplace. Stow it.
Yeah.
Okay. George Hedge, who was the wing DM. You remember Hedge? He was non-rated wing DM. Came down on an inspection tour one time, and he found that those goddamn oxygen tanks not in the airplanes. So he writes up a big report, sent it down. I answered it, sent it back. We don't need the equipment. Don't want to put it back.
As long as it's entered in the goddamn book.
Kept bumping around, and Hedge was so goddamn mad because they... we weren't doing, and he had told Paulie the problem. Paulie talked to me about it one time, and I explained it to him, our feelings about it. Paulie was kind of caught in the middle in a way, because he said, we're getting the instructions from 7th Air Force, you know, we got to kind of comply with it. So he bucked it up to 7th Air Force for a decision, based on, as he told me, he says, I'm passing on for operational considerations. You know, rather than a maintenance deal of this type. So it went to PACAF headquarters. And it came back once, it went back. That damn thing hung around for 4 months, I think. And the way it was resolved, Edmondson, three-star, Lieutenant General Edmondson, who was the PACAF vice commander, came over on an inspection trip one time, came to Benoit, said he wanted to see the ranch. And I invited him to fly with us the next day. He was came in the afternoon, talking with him that night, you know, would you like to fly a mission, General? He says, yeah, like. So he flew with us the next day. We had a six shipper and we had a milk run mission. It was one of those about 15 miles north of Benoit, you know. Jack Womack was leading it. And no, Bill Wildman was lead. Jack Womack was in second. I took the number six ship with and put Edmondson with me in the jump seat, in number six. The briefing was perfect. The start engines was right on a second. The taxiing out was right on a second. The lineup, everything was beautiful. We got off the ground. We circled up, pull up together. We hit the IP point. Beautiful. Everything was a beautiful, just flat perfect. We start down in on a target. I had Jack Langhorne on the right seat, in the left seat with me, you know. I looked over to Jack and he looked at me and same thought was going through our minds. Jesus, this is
too easy.
This is so easy. This guy will think there's nothing to this. We're down on a target, lead hollers, ground fire, I'm hit, pick up hits. Number two hollers, ground fire, I got hits too.
Well, that's a bitch was hitting the base, that guy up there on that target.
And I looked over at Jack and he, you know, looked back and again, we both thought, I thought, that goddamn Wildman is hoking this up.
Yeah, he's building one.
he knows, you know, and he's just throwing this in there. But he pulled off. And he lost an engine and got back in okay. At the end of the runway, his tire went flat and they had to tow the bird back in. Number two, oh, he came in all right. He didn't have to lose anything. But anyway, the clincher was after. Of course, we had Edmondson in there at the debriefing and then, of course, it turned out, yeah, pretty goddamn heavy ground fire, I think. Four of the six planes had holes in them, and number one lost the engine, you know, so it's legitimate. So he gave Evanson his purple scarf and took the pictures. About 2 hours later, he's leaving and getting on his airplane, and the last thing he did before he climbed on his airplane, he called me over and he says, hey, Mac, come over and shook hands. He says, that was a hell of a mission. I really appreciate that. And he says, oh, by the way, don't worry about those oxygen tanks. I'll take care of it.
That's how you get a lot.
We didn't hear another goddamn word.
I'm going down and get a beer.
Get more things done that way than you did the other one.
Well, I didn't know he even knew anything about it. You know, yeah, bring me one, Jim. I didn't even know he had any idea or knew anything about the oxygen tanks, but that helped. No, in contrast to what your time over there and Jim, when he got there, of course, you got to realize the squadron was formed in 66, and once you got a squadron formed, you had some organization and some perhaps more requirements to comply with. But we had a full-scale checkout program.
Well, that's what I was telling him, and he said, remember, we were only 14 pilots.
Yeah. Well,
you know, that
no,
was
when a guy hit, unit. When a guy hit the ranch, he was listed
when
as...
He became a squadron in the late 66. Up to that time, it was a... Detachment.
Well, actually, January 67, I think, was when it moved to Benoit, was when it became a squadron. Before that, it was...
No,
it became
a squadron in October 66.
Yeah,
that's the birthday of the squadron.
Okay. October 66.
October 15,
but then they changed the designation in January. They changed it from an SOS to...
Well, they changed it from Air Commando to SOS.
And I think that's when they started becoming an organized unit, in my own mind.
Well, you had Dennis in there, and he was an old maid. He loved it. Paperwork, you know, that sort of stuff.
And they started looking for Stanibel and things like this, and in-country checkouts.
But until the squadron went to Benoit and got separate from the rest, it really didn't have a true life of its own.
Formal program.
Yeah.
Well, I was at Thompson Newton, and I got my checkout for the Flint Country, and you know, it was getting the right seat, I think, maybe twice, and the next mission, you went in the left.
Yeah.
It was with an IP, and I think I flew, what the hell was it, required team, so many missions, and... Then you were flatland checked out.
On, what you had was a formal training and checkout program. A guy came in there and he was just in there as a pilot. He was a right seat pilot.
We didn't even use checklists.
He had 16 missions. He had to fly 16 missions flatland in a right seat, 16. And 16 missions, mountain missions, before you put them in the left seat.
Oh, we didn't have that. We just swapped back and forth.
Well, remember, we had a whole bunch of pilots, too. In 68, we had 29 lieutenant colonels, 35 majors. I don't know how many captains, but, two lieutenants, one of whom was the adjutant. Unrated.
Yeah.
The other was the intelligence officer, I guess. But we had 100 pilot air crew squadron.
100?
100 pilot air crew.
Wow.
100 air officer air crew. I'm talking about, that includes navigators. We had a goodly number of navigators.
66,
what you had, about 40? No, 66, there were one time were 14 air crew members.
Well, with that big a unit, they had the rules how long they
would take. Of course, we had 25 airplanes.
Well, I got there, I think we had 8.
It's going to be a long time for supper, folks.
We had 25 airplanes and 300 people in the squadron, 100 officers and 200 airmen.
Well, by that time, with that many people, we had a lot of requirements in getting checked out, but that was just a justification. If you were good enough, you were checked out right away. Yeah. We had, really, in the group that went over with us, we had a lot of people with some age on them, and guys that hadn't flown for a long time, they didn't want to be there.
That's right.
I'm not too sure if they were ever any good. But we had a percentage of guys, I felt like, shouldn't have even gone through the training at
we had a classic, and you got me on this thing, so I'm not going to mention any names, but Jim knows, I'm sure, who the guy was. He was, he fits the bill of an elderly gentleman.
But his name's already on there.
It is, but okay, but
I'll expunge.
A lot of people didn't want to fly with him. I mean, they ducked it whenever they could. And he had applied for a transfer from the squadron, and the ops, Avery was the ops and running the squadron then, really, and wouldn't approve it for some reason or other. I don't know what the hell the reason was. But I flew with this guy one time, and actually, on the mission, I had to take the controls away from him. He just flat lost control. Grabbed the wheel and said, okay, I got it. And, all right.
And, you're getting it. How's all together?
I'm just talking about one example.
Well, I hope you're not trying to tell me that everybody before me.
Don't pull that.
Don't tell me that.
Don't pull that, Luke.
We're all from the ranch.
That's Bill Pucluta.
Didn't have any rejects anyway.
Hi.
Tell me later on, and tell me, with the facts, he did a hell of a good job, because, you know what they were flying, and he was alone, was by himself, and he was all right.
Yeah.
That type of a mission, and that type of a airplane, and everything. He had no problems, and everything was fine.
He was a classic example.
But
every
guy got
a job, you got to find it for him.
That's right. He did not, he wasn't a real ranch pilot. I mean, he was not belonging.
Well, on the other hand, when you're on the ground in the barracks and these kind of things, he did a lot of good things, you know. A nice guy, he could take a laugh,
give a
lot of experience to, you know, we had some lieutenants around, you know, he wasn't this bullshit type of thing, you know, he taught these guys.
He was a hell of a good guy.
Something about the airport, how to prepare a piece of paper and stuff like that. He just didn't belong in the airplane, that's just that simple. And
every unit needs this guy. There was another guy there that I remember who, on the ground, he did a hell of a job. I gave him a job as supply officer. Something, and you probably remember him too, Martin.
Well,
Martin.
I respect him a lot more. And like, what was his name, Emery or whatever his name was? Lemley. Remember Lemley?
Yeah.
We called him Silk Panty.
Yeah, huh? Lemley. Right. Lemley was.
He was just an asshole everywhere.
But Martin. I'm talking about a major, who was.
Hi, Lester. Let him down in orbit after.
He was...
Well, Les and I knocked around a long time. We first got to Vietnam. You know, Les was in our 67, crew.
67, 68.
Oh, yeah. Les really fucked up. You know, Les been flying ever since before he could walk. And Les was a rancher. And he come over there and... well, he likes the dollies. He likes the beer. Well, Les was all fucked up there the first couple of months. I went down to Les's barracks one night, you know. I'm an IP already, you know, Les didn't even check that. And what's his name was on his ass, Stewart. And
I went down there. Avery or Stewart?
Rob, both of them. And I went down there and I told Les, you know, I said, yeah, you're really in a shit house. You know, but we're friends, you know, let's get tomorrow morning and go to work, you know. And about a month later, old Les was checked out, lead, IP, and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, he just went through that little cycle. I think we all do, you know. We like to think that we're all perfect and never had a problem, but that's not true. Well, Les got his shit together. He was more interested in, steel and plywood and stuff like that. But he wasn't interested in flying at all.
There was a time and a place for that.
Yeah.
Oh. We made one heck of a good hooch out of a...
Well, that load, that guy that's down there last night talked to him, he was maintenance officer up at
Da Nang, yeah.
That was a steal in the son of a bitch. He could go out to that Navy and come back with the steaks. He wouldn't come back with a box of steaks. He'd have 7 or 8 and we'd feed everybody.
You know who I had designated as a squadron scrounger? Ayers, Don Ayers, remember?
Yeah.
He went over to Fan Rang one day in an airplane and came back and he had 300 rugs. 300, they were 3x5 type, you know, throw rugs.
Yeah.
And he, I don't know how the hell he got them. I never asked him. But I said, gee, are they legitimate? Don't worry. I said, well, hell, I don't want to hand them out and then have to come around and pick them up again, you know.
Well, we had a few cookouts the year I was there. You know, we'd get all this sergeants and engineers and, you know, and everybody. We'd have just a squadron thing, you know, stakes and all that.
Who's it? Benoit, didn't
it? Yeah, Benoit.
Benoit.
There was a little, like, park there, best I could describe it. Everybody, you know, be bringing in things, but we needed the best scroungers had to get the lettuce. Now, that was the tough thing. You could get goddamn steaks like anything, you know, but lettuce was the key. You had to put the best man on the lettuce.
The rowdies.
Ah, there they are.
Hey, Jim.
Is that right?
I think so.
Yeah. Well, I got there and I met him and I probably served on him 2 or 3 days. But I remember he was going to the airport to get his damn airplane. We'd had a hellish party the night before. And he said something to me about, do you have your gun? And anyway, he gave me the .45 and the M16. They'd both been sighted in the whole damn bit. That was mine. More or less associated.
One of the funniest stories is, I know Rob pretty well. One of the funniest stories, you know, he can tell you all these airplane stories. You can hear a million of those. But in his era, they were living downtown Saigon, and they had a house. You know, a guy had a room here and a room there and what have you. But anyway, things were getting all hairy, and they all had a lot of guns around. And Ralph's a gunner from way back. You know, he's a hunter and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, I don't know if it was VC or just a robber or what gets in their goddamn places that night. And the 3, 4, or 5 of them, whatever they have, they empty all the guns they got. This guy never did hit. And Ralph got hurt. You know, he ran into a door or some goddamn thing chasing this guy.
They had a goddamn house with a wall around it and all that.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. All the hooches down there had that.
Villas.
Yeah.
The villas inside.
Well, I lived in the hotel.
But you're talking about scrounging. One morning I went down to flight line, and of course we were always cramped for space, I mean room for this and that, and we had, that hangar was so crummy and crappy.
That's the only thing I'd ever say was bad about my Vietnam tour,
that crapper and hangar. But anyway, we had got a trailer for the crew chiefs and the line chief and the maintenance people. We had that out there, and that was legitimate. Go down there one morning and there's another trailer right beside it, same size and everything on it. God damn, it's painted too. It's painted OD, you know. And I look, and then a I asked Dave Willoughby, I said, Dave, where the hell did that trailer come from? He says, shit, I don't know. I said, it wasn't there yesterday. He says, no. Okay. About 3 days later, I got a visitor in the office. OSI. OSI captain. The upshot of it is that that trailer belonged to the Army all across the base. It had been sitting out there in the open field for weeks, and some of our guys had spotted it, and they'd watched it, and finally figured, shit, that doesn't belong to anybody. Nobody wants it. And we can use it. So one night they go over, and they haul the thing over, and goddamn, they painted it during the night. It was white one time. And they had it all set up, you know, overnight. So this guy, this OSI guy had us cold. I mean, he had the number on the trailer, and he said it's assigned to an Army first lieutenant over there.
Quite investigative.
yeah, assigned to an Army lieutenant over there, and he's pretty concerned about it, and we're sure that that trailer is down on your flight lines. And of course, I said, well, I really don't know anything about it. You know, I said, there's a trailer down there. I said, but I thought they, you know, it was issued to us. And no, sir, this is, we're pretty sure that he was very nice. So I said, well, what do you suggest should be done? He said, well, he said, if nothing is done, we might have to press charges against somebody. Continue the investigation. I said, well, if the trailer is the George Boone, I'm pretty sure. Anyway,
you going down to the 18th?
I can.
I need a beer if you're doing
well,
it.
Well, I will stay down there.
Oh, you're going to stay there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
He came, Boone and Joe Boyer.
Yeah.
George
Boyer
Boone,
was
Joe
the
Boyer.
Guy's name I was trying to think of before. Good.
They came to me one late, well, one afternoon and said, we know where we can get some air conditioners. And I said, well, you know, the common way to get them then was if you bought them over in
Taiwan
yeah. or the Philippines, anyway, you flew them back, see? So I said, what's this, an airplane deal? No, they're right over here. It was an Army base, I forget the name of it, but 7 miles away, 7-8 miles
Long
away.
Long Bend.
No, that's the great big one over there.
Yeah.
This is a smaller one.
Oh. Over where the 101st was?
No, I don't know whether the 101st was there or not.
I don't remember.
But they had a big BOQ with single rooms, and they had an air conditioner in every one of those rooms. And the outfit had vacated the base. And they just had a guard on the gate. And that was it. So we got I checked out a covered van from the motor pool. Got six guys, Boone and Boyer, and I think Les Easton might have been.
Harvey, was it Boone? I think you got the first names wrong, because Les and Boone were big on that project.
I think Les was in it.
Yeah.
And made them wear civilian clothes. They were in, shirts and things. But I kept my uniform on and drove up to the gate, so the guard looked. Yes, sir. Opens the gate, and we go in, circle around back of the BOQ. They're armed with screwdrivers and pliers and everything. Into the BOQ, it's dark, And I think we liberated 8 or 10 air conditioners. brought them back to the base, and that's how the orderly room had two air conditioners all of a sudden. The orderly room got two, and of course these, the guys whose hooches had the hooches, they got them, and then we had two left over. I forget what we did with them. Well, we gave them to the other hooches or something. But we spread them around. They were dispersed around proper. And
then we got some rocket boxes.
Yeah. But that, there was an OSI investigation on that too, except it never got down to us. They came to the base. And I was told, I heard about it, or was told about it or something, but the finger wasn't pointed at us, even though we had all the goddamn things. But that was one of the things that pissed me off all the time I was over there, was the treatment that the fighter guys got in contrast to what the ranch got. And I used to say that when I took over, I went and attended the weekly staff meeting of the wing commanders.
Well, that's what we need the commander to do.
And yeah. And
we don't need him fly airplanes, we need him to go command.
And you'd get
that's where Stuart fucked up.
You'd get the things going on there, and every chance I get I used to say, well, we need this and this, and I'd always add on, just like the fighter squadrons have.
Yeah.
Just like the fighters. That used to get. But it took, we finally got a building. We got a new ops building.
Yeah.
I never got the, I left, I guess, the day or about 3 days after the thing became available. I never got to get inside it. But at least we got the damn stuff going and got a new ops building. Were you ever at
Benoit? Who replaced you?
Rick Stoner.
Stoner. Yeah, okay.
Were you ever at Benoit?
Yeah, I was at Benoit.
Well, you know how the fighter guys lived. I mean, they had those nice operations buildings down the line with a snack bar in the back and all air conditioned.
They had an air conditioner on each little room over there on the other side of the base.
That's right, all their BOQs were all air conditioned. They had clubs in the BOQs.
We were orphans over there against the fence. That was the only thing. We were close to the club.
That's right.
We were staggering distance to the club. What more could you ask?
Yeah, all the time I went to clubs when I had a party,
Oh, we went to club every night.
Well, there was nothing wrong with our hooches once we got air conditioning.
Oh, no, it's super.
That was pretty good living.
Field grade, when I was there, field grade had fixed theirs up because we paneled it inside and then put an air conditioner on each end that we'd bought.
There was only that one.
Well, that was it. That was the only field grade hooch.
That's
because
right.
And we didn't have it full. We didn't have that many field grade officers.
Well,
to
we
fill
had
that.
A lot
That's
of,
right.
You know, Ruby, we had a lot of Deadwood LCs around.
Were
terminal or what, but they, because we were an LC, they had an air conditioned trailer. So the things these guys should be doing, are going out and pushing for these air conditioners and what have you. Yeah, they're comfortable. And, they don't realize what's going on. Well, I tell you, we accomplished a lot.
After the Tet thing there, I was a pretty ranking LC, so I wound up in a, I guess it was what they call a field grade hooch.
Yeah.
It wasn't in our area, but because there were guys my roommate in there, or not roommate, but next door guy was Bill, later became commander of the 90th Squadron, I forget what the fuck's name was. But, and other guys from the base, itself. And I bunked in there for a couple of months. Then when I became commander, I got eligible for the trailer. Moved over in a trailer. And that was the best goddamn living you could find. We had two of us. In fact, we had the best trailer in a complex, too, because it was the biggest. Jim Patrick, commander of the FAC squadron there, had his bedroom on one end. I had a bedroom at the other. It was a third bedroom in the center for guests. Full bath and everything, and a fully equipped kitchen. And he had a first sergeant, and I had a first sergeant, and that goddamn freezer in that refrigerator was full of meat.
You want
all the time.
Steaks, chicken, yeah, please.
What about you?
No,
steaks, chicken, chops, all of the goddamn time. So, I suppose, you know, once in a while, you run into somebody says, oh, what news is it? No, wasn't it tough over there? And I have to bite my damn tongue and say,
well, of course, you know, some of the young troops and the enlisted men didn't necessarily have it too good. It varied from time to time.
It varied from time to time, that's right. But through 68, we finally got air conditioners for most of the airmen's hooches. Couldn't get all of them because there were just too damn many of them. But we did get a lot of air conditioners. And they were able to do the same thing in the office, take space at the back of the hooch and make a little lounge out. And I know, hell, I got drunk in those places more times than, because, again, when I took over as commander, I'd go around to the hooch. You know, you'd go in and sit with the guys and have a few drinks, and after you hit about three hooches, three hooches in 3 hours, and Christ, you were flying, whether you knew it or not. But, you know, it's part of the game. You couldn't avoid it, or
sure.
You didn't want to avoid
you
it.
Didn't want
it was
to
a that, part sure. of the game. It was what you did to keep things right.
You also found out what was happening a lot of times.
You're damn right.
Your only source.
You're damn right. I found out more from those guys. Well, on a lot of things. There was one goddamn thing that I'm proud of, and I don't know about the rest of them. They probably all can make the same claim, but I didn't have a court martial. Didn't have to court martial. I had one drug case. One. Very little other Article 15. Had one goddamn good incident. Surprised me somewhat. Had two senior master sergeants come in the office one day. They were complaining about a buck sergeant. I was calling them names. He was inviting them to square off. I mean, he was a feisty son of a bitch. Just flat giving them trouble. And these two guys that they're telling me this, now they weren't small guys. I mean, they weren't big bruisers either. But I called the first sergeant, Mitchell. Hell of a good first sergeant. And I told him, I said, look, I'm going to tell you a story, and you can take it or do what you want to about it. But I was a GI. I spent 4 years as a GI, and I was a tech sergeant before I went into flying training. And in my time as a GI, I'll recall one incident where a guy gave one of our staff sergeants a bunch of lip. The staff sergeant took him out behind a barracks that night and beat the shit out of him. That's all there was to it. It wasn't anything more. And I said, now, if that sergeant that's giving you trouble should come into this office complaining about being beat up or thumped on or anything, I'd throw his ass right out of here. That's all. It took three of them. But they did it.
And the problem.
They took three of them. They got the kid, three of them. And they thumped him a little bit.
That's all?
You know, these are things that nobody knows about. I mean, these other guys don't know about it. They don't... you're talking here, for the most part, to, you know, the pilots, the air crews, and everything, and they had their problems, and they had their... Mm-hmm. But the guy that was the boss, the commander, inherited everybody's problems. And when you solved one, or when you did something, you know, you couldn't put it on a bulletin board, or you couldn't go out and say, hey, look at me, And so a lot of the things that went on behind them, like, you're Jim Umstead, and he's right, he's classic. When he was over there, he could care less about anybody but Jim Umstead. His concern was taking care of himself, getting enough booze, getting enough ass, and getting enough flying time, and that's it. See? And for the most part, that's really what everybody else was doing.
Well, that's what the pilots do.
Okay. So that a lot of the behind-the-scenes problems or behind-the-scenes actions to do things and to take care of things never come out or never get known or
Well, that's true. They walk out of the briefing at 4 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the morning. The airplane's ready. They don't worry about how it got ready, who filled the herbicide tanks, who fixed the holes from yesterday, got the hydraulic system back going again. How come the fuel pumps are turning today and they weren't turning yesterday? It's there. And then when they bring them back, shot to shreds, they go in for their briefing, and meanwhile they expect something to be done. They don't worry about how it gets done. Oh, yeah. And the same thing, the PE equipment. You know, I mean, we had some damn good troops working in there in personal equipment. You went in and hung your stuff up, and it was dirty and filthy, and you came back, and it had gotten cleaned or fixed or whatever. You didn't worry about it.
One of the, you know, I said earlier about the number of senior officers, you know, lieutenant colonels and majors and so forth that we had at the time. But there was one distinct advantage in that. And one of the things I tried to do was to give everybody a job. I organized it had been organized into flights, but it kind of fallen into, you know, by the way, so we reorganized the flights, but in the squadron there were really only the commander spot was authorized, the intelligence officers, the maintenance officer, and that was it.
Ops officer?
No, an ops officer wasn't authorized.
Didn't it? I thought we had an ops officer authorization.
We had. Well, you had them, but no, on a TO. You had a commander, you had an intelligence officer, and you had a maintenance officer, and that was it. There were three authorized officers in the squadron.
Didn't realize
authorized
that.
Positions. So your ops officer was, and of course, what had evolved or developed was ops and targeting and standboard, stand eval, and flight safety and PE and supply, and you know, all the
things that got to be done,
all the positions in a bigger outfit, the wing type outfit or something like that, that were authorized and had to be done. So I took all these guys and tried to give everybody a job, to give them, and one of the reasons for that was to you know, the way you flew, you're finished at noontime, and a lot of guys go back to hooches and start hitting the bottle.
That's right. You wouldn't have recognized an alcoholic most of the time I was there.
Damn right.
Because everybody drank
drunk,
like that.
Yeah. Well, like I told my wife, once in a while she says, you drink too much most of the time. When I was in Vietnam, I drank 10 times as much as I have before or since.
Of course, that was one of the things, you know, it helped you go to sleep. Sometimes that was kind of tough.
Well, that's right. Did. And, you know, but actually, again, going back to, I never had to take a guy, well, yes, I did. I took one guy off an airplane. And I don't know whether he was drunk or scared, really. It was a guy named Smith. What the hell was his first name? He had a funny first name. Jim would remember. Jingo Smith, the Doty Smith, there's some goofy name. But I think he just went a little bananas. He wasn't, but the first report I got was, he was crew, he was evidently co-pilot, right seat. And after the it came off the target run, he goes back and takes his M16 out the door, you know. Empty soul, goddamn thing, shooting it something out the door. I mean, shooting nothing. So they kind of focused some attention on him, and then he did a couple other goofy things. So I took him out. I grounded him, got him off the flight schedule, and told him to go see the flight soldiers. We arrested him for 2 or 3 weeks, and he came back, but... hey, who was that we were just talking about? I was remembering a guy named Smith.
Dino? Dino Smith?
Was that his first name?
Yeah.
Dino? I said it was a funny name.
The guy who grounded?
Okay, yeah, that's yeah, I was just...
Jumped out of the seat and started shooting out of the back end of the airplane?
There we go.
Yes. In fact, you and I had an argument over him.
We did?
Yeah.
I don't remember that. Over there?
Yeah. Well, semi-argument. I'd heard that he was going to be, like, grounded for 3 or 4 weeks, and then I heard that, we'll just ground him until he goes home, give his flying status back. And I come and said, I think that's shit. And you said, well, that's not the way it is. Do you remember, don't you remember that?
Not specifically, but...
We discussed it anyway.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I figured, you know, fine if he can't do it. And then you figured the same way. So we argued a couple of minutes. Or I was arguing, you weren't.
Well, I was just recalling...
There was a navigator in that same category. I can't remember his name. A little smart-ass guy. I can't remember his name. He wanted to... be grounded the last 2 months, you know, and then get his status back when he left.
It's bad. Did you have any rules on when you told the guys it was their last mission or anything? Did they know when they were flying their last one? You let them know?
I don't see the sense of that.
Oh,
what
unless
the hell
he
was
had.
That
a guy might say, you know, at the club, I'm going to fly my last one on the 1st, but he might fly it on the 4th or the 27th. No, there wasn't any of that.
No. I'll tell you what, a guy had the opportunity. I mean, you know, like some guys got a little itchy at the last month or something like that. Maybe they wanted to lay off or get grounded. They could go to ops first. That was their first go. But in all honesty, nobody ever got to me, or nobody ever came to me and asked me for that thing. And if they had, I'd have just flat said, no, take your turn with everybody.
Probably the worst
thing
to
do,
as far as I'm concerned, is to sit down, and then you start getting concerned, you know, and then they hit you with a rocket, and then you get to go clanky.
Right.
You got to keep your momentum up, really.
But you couldn't, I mean, you know, if you did that for one, you'd just throw the whole...
In fact, I flew in the afternoon and left that night. Well, I was supposed to leave tomorrow. And an airplane came in, and a transportation came up looking for me, and they found me, and they threw me an airplane off I go. I don't even know if I signed up. They said they'd take care of it. That's the best way to do it.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, there were very, very few instances of that nature that I remember. No, it was, of course, as we've all known and experienced, that the morale and the esprit of that outfit was just tremendous. Even like we were talking about the later years, like when we were loaded with a bunch of guys that might not have wanted to be there and didn't have much choice in this type of thing, you know. But one thing I told everybody, when they came in the squadron, I gave everybody a briefing. Situation as best as I could put it together from intelligence reports and so forth. The mission. About a half hour briefing in the orderly room. And I always wound up by telling them, we've got a good outfit, and anybody that doesn't want to be in it
come and tell me, and I'll get you out of it. And I had no problem getting anybody out. The goddamn wing was always on our ass. We had a bigger authorization for pot. See, the airlift squadron's authorized something like 16 crews, and we were authorized 25 crews. So they'd dwindle down, and the bastards, every once in a while, they'd, you know, call or send a memo down, we need three pilots, four pilots, or something like this. And I used to fight that like hell, because, again, if you let yourself be screwed that way, you'd be screwed continually.
We hear a lot of complaining about majors and lieutenant colonels and blah, 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 which we did have maybe an abundance of. But one thing is that created, we had a few bummers, you know, as far as our squadron was go. I'm sure they were good in maintenance or supply or maybe the Pentagon, but they weren't.
Well, a lot of the people hadn't been on flying status for quite a few years.
That was just a few guys.
But the big group of people there, wicked. Really,
when I say off flying status, they hadn't been flying as a primary duty. They were still on status, an ROTC instructor. Yeah, or they were something in ops and planning up at headquarters or something.
And they were past that. But we had enough nucleus there where a guy get a lot of head. Maybe you drank too much last night, you know. Well, we had that thing going on. You just come down and wake me up, you know, I'll fly. You know, I know, questions asked.
You have to remember, too, it was a crew flying. This wasn't fighter pilot flying.
Yeah.
And it wasn't individual flying where all the onus is on one guy. And
That's a two-man airplane in that operation.
Oh, yeah.
The guys helped each other out and worked together.
Fantastically.
For the most part, and that's what helped make the outfit what it was. And even when you had so many guys, let's say, at one time there that maybe didn't want to be there, the spirit got to them. And
the momentum would catch them up, for the most part.
And eventually they came around. You know, like, I'll tell you that, first briefing in my orderly room, for a lot of guys, I had a lot of stony-faced guys sitting there, you know, because they'd just come out of the snake school in the Philippines. And
they heard the Charlie Hupp stories, you know.
Oh, and they, yeah. And
so they were scared to death.
Sit there and
you know, you hear so many stories coming in there, you think, Christ, how could I fly through all that metal there? And, you know. It was head up, but you know, it wasn't.
But really, those were the exception. A lot of the heavy percentage,
you know, it's like anything else. The little hairy thing, the bad thing sometimes, is the very thing that pulls people together.
Well, you always. I think everybody was always pumped up when they went down the target, no matter where it was. You were always hopped, but that doesn't mean that every target you went on was. Was most of them, you went in, you sprayed, you came off, and nothing had happened.
And those mornings you get up,
you go down there
and there's 100 feet of fog, and all you do is sit there and spurt it. You know?
Yeah, I remember this.
Well, now see, when I went through, we weren't allowed to spray on top.
Oh, we
did. If we couldn't see the target. Now, I'm not saying we never did, especially in the valleys where you were pretty well, you had the mountains on either side. But our ops rule said, huh, you couldn't do that.
We didn't spray.
I did. On top of the fog? Yeah, I did.
Well, of course, a lot of guys didn't want to ever bring herbicide back. They figured they'd hit something with it.
That's right. But, well, that's why we had Rungsat. That was a tertiary target zone. Primary, secondary, tertiary.
Like an oil dump.
Hell yeah. We never had to come back, at least during 68 there, because Rungsat was the goddamn dumping ground out there. Anytime you wanted to.
People got a few shots.
Well, we went through a little shortage of pilot thing. You know, I'd fly two sorties, come back and have a little Campbell's soup, go down there, and I'd take two new guys. We'd go out over the ocean or down a Rumsack someplace, and we'd play a ranch in the afternoon, you know.
I say that, again, that's something that we never had, because the only thing that went out that wasn't a real mission was if you went out to survey, doing crop surveys. But the guys learned how to fly on the real missions. We didn't have any spare birds or spare time to fly
I don't know whether Jim will like this or not. I'm going to tell you, you know, he got a special award for flying how many goddamn missions before you picked up any ground fire?
Well, I told him about that earlier. Charlie didn't believe that. Did he said you couldn't get by 12. You know.
How many did you fly?
Oh, I'd have to look at my thing at home. It's a fantastic number. I was about to come home, though, before I got hit.
It was
You're kidding.
100.
Oh, my God.
Well, it was up in the hundreds, wasn't it?
I think it was like 186.
Yeah, it was less than 200, but it was...
We'd land, everybody come running over my airplane and look at it, you know. In fact, we'd get some guys who were like this. Well, you know, they had to go flying with me just because I didn't get...
Yeah, I can't. Well, I wouldn't have wanted to fly with you. I figured you were so due that...
You know, one of the... You know, a lot of these things crop up, these little traditions or gimmicks or morale builders or whatever. You know, that was the cherry parties.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. See, we went a hell of a long time before we got a cherry party out of
here. I threw my own party. Yeah. Closed the club.
I can't remember anybody going a week. I can't. I don't think ever.
Well, I remember one time we were, I was flying out of Da Nang. We're going down, and I forget who I was flying with. I think it was... Jim, but anyway, my idea was get your ass down there. When you go over a creek, push it down, don't push it up, you know. And I'm sitting there, you know, and a perfect example's coming up. We're coming down, I'm flying too. There's a river, you know, not the trees aren't dense on either side. And, you know, this is, you know, where they can get you, you know, so push that fucker down, you know. So, you know, I'm pushing down, and as the lead airplane goes by there, he gets his ass ripped. I thought the tail just disappeared off the airplane in front of us. And we go by, and the guy behind us gets racked, and I don't get a shot. I don't get a hole. But, man, I went down over that water, you know. And I don't, maybe they were reloading in between lead and me, you know. But that really impressed the shit out of the guys flying with anyway. You know?
No, I'd have avoided you. I figured you were, when you got your share, you it was going to come so bad, I didn't want to be close to you.
Well, I only wound up with a couple.
Well, that was one of the running running deals of the time.
That's unbelievable.
Did Umstead lose his cherry yet?
No.
Oh, in fact, I was within 5 or 6 weeks of coming home.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
He was short timer when he picked up his first ground fire.
I'm not too sure that somebody didn't put that hole in there before I left until this day.
I didn't hear it.
Oh. John's shaped with a screwdriver.
Yeah.
I'll tell you though, along those lines though,
how's it back, Jim?
Doing pretty good, Ralph. Good to see you.
Huh? You remember Art?
Sure, Art. How you doing?
Hey, big Ralph.
We met before,
you're
in Paul Cecil.
Yeah, Ralph. Good to see you.
But all that ground fire shit, we were briefed to, we were going down on Dong Dong or Hong Dong or something, but it was built as a VidCon
R&R
camp.
Oh, Dong Ha.
Dong Ha,
yeah.
So we go down there, and I got one of these guys, you know, that's got the shakes and air transplant, you know, and he was really shaky.
And then the final leg I came
from. And we were leading, so we had a navigator.
I really didn't know when I was going to get
it. It was almost... about the only time we kind of plum tree because we went down over it, pulled up, and it came back. You know, because we could do it all in one shot.
Yeah.
And we went down the first time, and Intelligence said we were going to get our ass flat. There wasn't a shot. You know, just
flat. It wasn't long after that.
So anyway, we peeled up, come back around, and we're going down about halfway down the second time. And a goddamn bird flew in. You know, we flew with the windows open. And the bird hit in the panel right behind me. That's how it goes splat, you know, just like a 20 millimeter, you know. And that little bird probably was only that big.
How you getting along?
And we had blood.